Well, today's the 15th of January, 2008, and I'm Carrie Klein here with Michael Klein, about to interview John Minty. Would you introduce yourself, though?
I'm John Minty, M-I-N-T-Y, and building commissioner, zoning enforcement officer in the town of Concord.
And give us your date of birth, just to keep the story in perspective.
Way back in 53, November 30th, 1953.
Okay. And will you talk about your people and where you were raised?
Yeah, I was raised in Bedford, which is the town next door to Concord. And although my family has a very strong Concord presence in terms of my mother having grown up in Concord, and then despite the fact we lived in Bedford, I spent most of my life in Concord on a daily basis, and as it turns out, I ended up working in Concord. So
on a daily basis?
Yeah, we had so much extended family that were in Concord that pretty much ended up from grandparents to aunts and uncles to spending a considerable amount of time in Concord almost every day.
Tell us some about those people and those early experiences.
Well, because of the large family, I ended up, my grandfather ended up, after his retirement, farming in Concord. So we would go over and walk around the fields picking vegetables. He and my grandmother lived on Elm Street, which the family had lived for probably over 100 years. And so we spent a lot of time at my grandparents' home, a lot of time working with my grandfather, you know, going to his little farm stand, and he'd deliver vegetables constantly to us as I was growing up. He would come, and I'd see the trunk go up, and he would have crates full of vegetables being delivered. I spent most of my childhood just hanging around various places in Concord. I had uncle or a great uncle that owned Wilson Lumber Company, so I would spend a lot of time hanging around the lumber yard mixing paint, you know, in the back corner. In fact, there's a Chinese restaurant there now, and when I sit in that corner, I remember standing there mixing paint back probably when I was six or eight with my uncle. So it's kind of neat.
Can you include, this is just great, just include the names of the people as you talk about that?
That's Larry Kendall, who owned the lumber yard. You know, all these, the Hunt family, so he married a Hunt. And that family had 8 children. So those were all my aunts and uncles, all living all around Concord. The result of that is that Concord was a very busy place for me growing up, visiting aunts, mowing their lawns, painting houses, their houses. As I got older, plowing their driveways. So it was quite a bit of the connection to Concord was because of that large family that that existed.
And your grandparents, who were they?
My grandparents, Benjamin Ingham and Grace Ingham, they lived on Elm Street, 48 Elm Street, and they died in the probably when I was 12, 13, but I remember them. I was old enough to remember what they were like, which was nice, which I wanted for my kids as they grew up as well. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit more about them.
Well, he ended up working for an insurance company, and we'd get on the train every day. People have told me that they used to watch him walk the train and walk back at the end of the day, and they could set their watches to when they passed when he passed their homes, because he was such a meticulous, timely gentleman, apparently. And then when he retired, what he wanted to do was basically to have nothing to do with paperwork or whatever, and he rented a piece of land and he did some farming for throughout his retirement until he passed away. So, and he had a little piece of land down on Cambridge Turnpike in Concord, in which he had a farm stand set up. And so his, you know, the way he wanted to retire and do what he loved was to do farming, and he ended up doing that in his retirement. Grace, my grandmother, was a very portly woman who just loved spending her entire day in the kitchen just cooking constantly. And that's what I remember of her. Never remember her anywhere other than in the kitchen.
Fixing.
Making. Any, you know, cooking, baking, was what she did constantly. So, and I really don't have any memory of her outside. I don't remember her in the living room. Just in the kitchen.
What were her specialties? Do you remember?
Yeah, she did this thing where my grandfather would go into Haymarket Square in Boston just before Christmas, and he would buy half a dozen types of nuts that they had in the market, and he would bring them back. And she had this thing where she combined all of these and salted them and baked them and added spices to them, and that was that's what I remember from as being a very important thing to me when I was young, was to get hold of some of these things around Christmas time. She always had a, in the kitchen, they always had a large tin of donuts, and it was almost like it was never empty of donuts. And my grandfather in the living room had two jars of red licorice and black licorice, and those jars were never empty either. They were always filled for the grandchildren that came over and would end up having licorice with my grandfather, because I think he took it as an opportunity to be able to grab some candy as well. So those are kind of my memories of those early years at my grandparents' house.
Is there homemade donuts?
Yeah, they were, yeah. My what's kind of nice is that the donuts that they used to have in the kitchen constantly. Kind of a nice thing was that my father was an artist, and he did a lot of drawings. When he was dating my mother, he would come to the house, and as they ate dinner, he would probably be pretty annoying, but he would be sketching family gatherings on napkins and scrap pieces of paper on the back of pieces of paper. And what's nice now is that I was able to take some of those and frame them. So I actually have pictures of that he sketched of like Thanksgiving 1955, and it'll show my grandfather at the end of the table and my grandmother coming out with food in her hands, and they're he was, you know, he's a great artist, and so it is one where, you know, it was like a cousin Derek acting as Batman, is Derek with his wings held out like he had some tablecloth on his arms or something, and all of this is all sketched out, and I frame them and have them on my wall in my living room, so that's kind of neat, and a lot of that furniture from that house ended up going to me when my aunt passed away. So I actually have it in a room with the same dining table, the same chairs, the same buffet, with this artwork on the wall, which shows all of that same stuff from that living room back 50 years ago. So it's kind of nice. Yeah.
This wasn't actually his side of the family, was it?
No, it was, he was, my father grew up in Belize, British Honduras, and my grandfather owned a shipping company where he shipped mahogany out of the Yucatan and Belize, probably in the around World War II, right after World War II ended, he bought some old Liberty ships and would load them up with mahogany and ship them to New York and Boston. And so my father grew up in that environment and would walk through the Yucatan with the tree siders or the surveyors, and would locate trees that would be cut. So he was, as a young boy, he spent his childhood walking through the Yucatan jungles with these gentlemen marking trees and locating trees for shipping off to the States. When he turned 18, there was the war, and he, being a British citizen, he signed up for the RAF, and he went. The British Air Force, and he actually flew on bombing raids over Germany and ended up being a navigator, and so he would be the person who would be looking through the site and telling the guy when to push the button when they were at the right location over whatever their target was. And after the war, he ended up flying the plane back to Canada, where he remembers coming through Concord. They gave him a pass to he can go on any train, but he has to be in New York in 2 weeks to get on a boat to go back after delivering his plane. And he came down, and when he came through Boston, he realized that, you know, he could take another train and come out to Concord. He did that on his trip back to England, which was kind of fascinating that he ended up in Concord. And this was at least a couple of years before he even came back to Concord and met my mother. So he was a boy from Belize ending up in Concord, which is pretty amazing that those kind of things happen.
Yeah. And why? Why did he select Concord?
As it turns out, he came back after the war. He signed up for the GI Bill, and the United States apparently had a cooperative thing with Britain, in which anyone who flew for the RAF could also be on GI Bill. So he he did not want to be in the shipping business. He did not want to do mahogany. He wanted to be an artist. So he spent, I think, 3 or 4 years in Europe on the GI Bill studying art, and then he ended up coming back to New Orleans in New York City. He knew Henry Miller. In fact, I have a little note from Henry Miller saying, "Yes, I will return your leather jacket the next time I see you," and whatever. According to my mother, we never got the jacket back from Henry Miller. But a lot of the artists that he trained with and traveled through Europe are artists that are well known, and you know, designers and artists. That was the group he was hanging out with. And he came back to Concord apparently because he loved what he saw when he came that chance visit. On the train on his trip down through from Canada delivering his plane. And so a few years later he was in Boston, and someone offered him a job doing some construction in Concord to make a little bit of money, and he came out with some of his artist buddies to Concord, and he ended up here we are, the building business. He was renovating a barn at Concord Academy. And my mother was a librarian in the library, and so he ended up saying, you know, how about an ice cream? When you get off, how about an ice cream? And then the rest was history, and he never left Concord. So that's kind of a strange connection. When they ended up, going to Paris, my twin sisters were born in Italy, and where actually because of the lack of healthcare, one of them died in Italy, and then after coming back, they had myself and my younger sister. So my older sister Deborah is actually a twin that was born in Florence, and I have a twin sister buried somewhere in Florence. Someday I need to get over there, but his studies in Europe in various under various artists. My father was a very good artist. He taught at the Cordova for a number of years. He found he couldn't make any money at it, so he ended up writing a newspaper for he got a job with Raytheon. He actually was editor of the Raytheon newspaper for 20-something years. So. But his love was always art. And myself growing up, there was, you used to walk in our house and through the basement, and he had the whole basement, and you would walk in and all you'd smell is oil paint. And hit his brush slapping against the canvas with the classical music blaring. So that was kind of my childhood and watching my father do art, which is a great thing to learn as a child, was that creativity. So particularly with my own leanings towards being an engineer type. It was great to see that every day. We'd all head off to church because he would pretty much insist we go to church, and then he would tell us that his church was his canvas in the basement painting. That's where he found God. So that was how I don't know how he got away with that, but he did.
And your parents' names?
John Ross Minty. I'm John Ross Minty Jr. My father was John Ross Minty, and my grandfather was John Ross Minty. Them being British, they didn't approve of putting 1, 2, or 3 after the name because that was only for British royalty. So I got a junior at the end of my name instead of the third or something.
And your mother's name?
And my mother is Mary Ingham Minty, and she was the Inghams that grew up on Elm Street.
So the community where you actually grew up, can you talk a little bit about that home and that community?
In Bedford? It was, Bedford is a kind of, when I was there, it was, throughout my childhood, it was kind of a sleepy little community. My graduating class was 300 or so, kind of, normal childhood, nothing eventful, really. Always had a, we grew up in a, the house that we grew up in, which probably led to me doing what I do, was an old hunting lodge. And people used to come out of Boston and would come out to this estate. It was called Upper Bouldercroft. And so this house was really a hunting lodge. It had a 6-foot fireplace. You could throw 6-foot logs in. And because of that, my father being an artist and basically didn't do any type of labor other than slapping a paintbrush, it gave me the freedom as a youngster to, I had free rein to tear anything apart that I wanted to. And so I would go into like the living room. I remember one day I convinced my parents that the surround around the fireplace would look better if it was gone. So I tore it all out, and we would go through rooms, and I would I'd add closets and all this kind of stuff. And there was really, I got to give them credit. They, as a kid of like 12 or 14, they were letting me to face this house that I'm not sure I would let my son do today. So that kind of, I built decks and renovated things and finished off attic space. And there was so much of that I did that I'm really not sure that was appropriate of my parents to let me do, but the results were good. So it's, it turned out well. And that house ended up, when I was a junior in high school, we drove home. The whole family was out shopping for a prom dress for my younger sister. And as we drove up the road was blocked, and we pulled up to the bottom of the driveway, and the house was, our house was totally in flames, and had, was burning down. My father was running around the yard thinking we were inside, and so when we arrived, everyone, you know, oh great, they weren't, no one was inside. They actually thought I was inside, because there's no way I would want to go shopping for a prom dress. And they were right, but there must have been some reason I was, had to somehow go with them to do that. And then so the house ended up getting burning up, and the result of that was that we took a little, we went across the street to a woman who had a large estate and had a little cottage, and we moved into the cottage. And for 2 years, we ended up, we hired a my parents hired a contractor to renovate the house again. And his name was Bill Waite. And during the summer, I had nothing to do. When I was about 17, I'd wander over there, and I'd ask the guys that were tearing the house, you know, putting all the charred stuff in dumpsters. I asked them if there was anything I could do. And they said, yeah, you know, move that pile into the dumpster or whatever, and I would do that. And then Bill Waite Sr. came by one day and said, who's this kid? And I said, oh, he's the owner's son. Well, he looks a mess, covered in soot. And so after, then the next day I'd come back and I'd say, is there anything I could do? And they gave me more work to do. And finally, Bill Waite said to me, you know, I really ought to pay you for this. So he ended up paying me. And the result of that was that I went to work as a junior in high school. I started working for Bill Waite. He'd say, hey, can you come on this other job? And so I ended up working for him. And the result of that was that it was kind of an amazing thing. Bill Waite, when I ended up going to college, Bill Waite said to me, what's it costing you to go to college? And I would give him the whatever that year's tuition was, and then he would say, okay, when are you off? When's your winter break? And he would do the math and come up with an amount he was going to pay me based on what my cost was to go to college. So other than some money that my parents, very little money my parents had that they had set aside for college, which is something like, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 then, all the rest of it came from Bill Waite agreeing every year we'd have that discussion. What's it, how much is your college this year? How much? How many hours can you work? And I would come home for the winter break, the Christmas break, and I would be driving in one day, and I'd be working the next morning for Bill Waite somewhere, doing construction jobs. One of my first jobs, actually, which was kind of fascinating, was putting an addition on the Colonial Inn when I was 18 years old. And that addition, every time I go in there for dinner or I inspect it, it's kind of nice because I can actually see the. I remember, you know, 18 years old, being up in the attic, removing these boards from the 1700s and bringing them down and putting them on the walls. And he had an old Finnish carpenter, Clyde Hitchcock, that was in his, must have been in his 60s and 70s at that point. And Clyde and I got along great, so Clyde asked that I would help him. So I ended up doing all of the finish work throughout the Colonial Inn with Clyde Hitchcock for like 2 years. We worked on that project. And he would always ask for me to help him. And so that was kind of nice, being able to do that, working in the center of Concord on that project. Like I said, I go in there now and I look at the finish work to see how good a job I did when I was 18 years old.
You were taking 18th century boards and putting them on the wall, you said?
Yeah, they wanted the, in the village, if you go into the Colonial Inn, there's a village forge, which is supposed to be this very old looking tavern. And the reason, the way we made it look old was to pull all these old flooring boards that were 18 inches wide, 2 feet wide, that were up on in the floor of the attic, and we brought them down and put them on the wall as wainscoting, and it's very effective. When I'm sitting there having a drink, I look around and like it really does. You'd never know that these were the old attic floor for 150 years or whatever, up in the upper parts of the colonial end.
This is great. I mean, you're just an ideal person to think about, you know, what was Concord like physically in your youth.
Mm-hmm.
Were there modern homes, and what were the goals? Have there been goals in terms of architecture and changes to the built environment, or trying to preserve a certain look? What's your sense of that?
Well, you know, I've been building commissioner, building inspector for 23 years. So when I first started, it was vacant lots having new homes built on them, and then a lot of people building additions and renovating their homes. Today, there has been a substantial change in the way Concord is changing, because what we see now is what we call teardowns, where someone will come in and there'll be a small cape or ranch split level on a nice lot in a good neighborhood, and they'll pay a tremendous amount of money, you know, $700,000 to there's a teardown in Concord right now where someone paid almost $2 million for a house, which they then immediately tear down and build a mansion in its place. So we do, I would say, probably this past year, out of 24 new homes, I think 20 of those were teardowns. So very few vacant lots that are being built on. The substantial majority of homes being built in Concord today are teardowns, so-called, and every house that's replaced is replaced with a modern mansion.
Mansion?
Mansions, yeah. They're all being replaced with homes that are $2 million to $5 million. So as you can imagine, if you're in a neighborhood in which this is happening a lot to, the whole feeling of a streetscape changes over 5 years or 10 years as each house comes up for sale and is torn down and a big modern box replaces it. Now, with that said, there are some streets in Concord, Monument Street, which my farm was on, Lowell Road, Garfield Road. There are some streets in Concord that the homes that are being built are beautiful architectural structures. They are, you know, highly designed structures which these are structures that have tunnels between garages and houses, and then another tunnel between the house and the indoor swimming pool, tunnels between the main house to carriage house. There's a home up on off Monument Street which has $1 million swimming pool, and the bottom of the pool is designed by a Soho artist in fiber optic lighting so that it reflects the sky above, so that there's a computer program that flashes the lights so that as you look in the pool it looks like the evening sky. I mean, some truly, you know, beautiful architecture when you get up in the very very expensive mansions, which is nice because I get to see all that. I get to look at the plans, which are done by really great artists, great, you know, every wall, every square foot in the house has a plan showing how it's being developed, you know, beautiful architecture, beautiful siting of these structures on the lots, and that's one of the nicest part of my job, is being able to see these plans, and be able to see them over. These structures take 2 or 3 years to build, and be able to see them go up and be able to walk through them in the end and see what's being built. This is Fidelity investment money. There is Charlene Engelhart, which is Engelhart Silver Fortune. Her father they call Goldfinger, Ian Fleming Goldfinger. These are, you know, substantial wealth building in Concord. And some of the newer players are like Kevin Garnett, new Celtics basketball player, just bought a home up on Monument Street. So it's that kind of, we found with Fidelity that one moved in 5 years ago, and now all the vice presidents, one by one, are all coming out and doing the same, tearing down property. Boston Scientific, gentleman just bought two lots in a row, and he's turning one house into a carriage house and building a large estate up on a hill right off behind the North Bridge in Concord. So those, but what you find is because of that, there is a strong movement against mansionization.
Against what?
Mansionization is what they call it. They want to prohibit people from doing what is happening because it's substantially changing the streetscapes of roads within Concord, with the feeling of the town.
Of what did you say?
The streetscape and the feeling of what you get when you go down, you know, a road. If you grew up in Concord and you've been here all your life, you recognize like Monument Street as a winding country, you know, road with farms, and it's now become a winding road with mansions along its length. And I don't see that as something that's going to change unless the money dries up somehow. So that's kind of what we've been seeing. And then there's every year there's people have proposed zoning bylaws that would try to slow that down, slow the change down, prohibit tear downs. As part of that, a few years ago, I decided that one of the ways I could help with that, to slow it down a little, was to make a determination. It's basically my determination as a zoning enforcement officer, whether or not I issue a building permit to these people. And one of the options I took was to require anyone who wishes to tear down an existing structure on a lot that doesn't meet zoning, I send them to the Board of Appeals. And that's been an important thing, because then it gives everyone the ability to show up at a hearing to speak for it or against it, particularly against it.
Everybody?
Anyone in town can, you know, show up, and the direct abutters are notified so that they are aware directly that there's a hearing on, that this house is coming down. Please show up, speak your mind, look at the plans, voice your opinion. And I think that's been very effective. I've done that for last 3 years. So.
In questionable zoning circumstances? Is that what you said?
It's when there's a non-conforming lot, which a substantial majority of these are, because people want to live in the centers, in Concord Center. And so there'll be that last little cape right down, you know, side road from the library or something, and they'll want to tear it down and build this monster home on the small lot. And really, when you think about it, it's the non-conforming lots that, because it's such dense development, is where you really should be holding a hearing and having it reviewed. So I think that was a positive step that I started doing. It was 2003 I started doing that. And it's valuable because people get this voice, their opinion about what's going to be happening to their neighborhood, and or particularly the lot across the street, a lot next door to them or whatever. I think it's been a very effective. They then set conditions on the permit, such as plantings and location of driveway and the height of the structure and the footprint of the structure and where the house is going to sit on the lot. So the board actually has creatively there's been some creative approval, so where they can actually satisfy the neighbors and the person ends up still building their little mansion so they move to Concord. See a lot of people coming into Concord from the city who are now, have put off having kids. They're now having kids. They both have two well-paying jobs. They know that Concord public schools are excellent schools, or they're sending their kids to Middlesex School, Concord Academy, Fenn School, Neshoba Brook School. All these private schools in Concord are a tremendous magnet to people that want to end up living in a community that's a nice community, that's well managed, and be able to drive 5 minutes to some of the best private schools in the country. So that's what draws this wealth to Concord. And you'll see these people actually live in these homes for 4 or 5 years, and then the kids are off into college, and then they end up selling a home and they're moving. So we see a lot of that.
So they've permanently affected the built environment, mm-hmm. and then they move on.
And they move on.
So there are no stipulations that would say that cape next to the library downtown needs to stay, or a certain size home needs to replace it.
That's correct. There's always people trying to find just the right zoning bylaw that would do that. And there's been nothing very successful in terms of what state law would allow the town to approve for zoning that would heavily restrict a teardown. And it's not just a Concord problem, it's Lexington, and it's all the towns that are experiencing this. It started out in California. We started hearing about California teardowns, what they used to call it, California teardowns. And then we started, about 10 years ago, started to see the same process beginning in Concord.
When do you trace it to?
About a decade ago. Became a substantial proportion of the new homes that I started issuing.
What did that feel like for you? You were well in place in your position.
Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily have a problem with that, because if I look at Concord history, I look at my own farm up on Monument Street. The family lore up there is that, well, you know, my aunt's house used to be a chicken coop that was up the road, and in 1890 they hauled it down on rollers after a snowstorm where they packed it, you know. So they were constantly moving structures all over the place. And if you look at Concord's downtown history and you read the current journals on Concord history, you'll see, well, this was the Monroe house. It used to be at the library site, and then it was hauled down using oxen to, you know, around the corner. My own aunt's house on Elm Street was twin daughters. Father was a builder, and he built these twin homes. And within about 40 years, the mirror image home was just slid around the corner using oxen. So we see that if you look back on the history of Concord, it wasn't happening as quickly as the change is occurring now. I mean, we definitely are at a period of time when change is happening quickly. And but I'm sure back in 1840, when, you know, a house was being hauled around the center of Concord to a new lot, I'm sure there were people just as upset saying, you know, that it's a terrible thing happening to Concord if we're, you know, finally building on that vacant lot down near the river or something, you know. I'm sure it was, because, I mean, that's human nature. And I do see a fascinating aspect of human nature where I will see people, that's because I've been here for so long, I will see people so adamant against an addition or a new house going up. And the advantage of being here so long is I then see them come to my office 5 years later and propose to do the exact same thing that they opposed from a neighbor. So it's kind of amazing, actually. I see it all the time. I see people that propose zoning bylaws that we adopt, and then they come in for permits, and I'll say, you can't. You have to go to historic districts, or you need to go to the Board of Appeals. And they will be amazed that they have to do that. And they were the people that wrote the bylaw that I am now enforcing. And it seems so amazing to me that their memory is so short or they didn't get that by adopting this bylaw it applied to them. I'm not quite sure what goes on there, but I see that all the time. It's amazing to me.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess when you talked about the movement of homes, those weren't necessarily different styles or one more grandiose, or were you dealing with that back then?
No, there was not the amount. When I first started, there was not the amount of money being put into structures. There were people with the money were not, they were average Concord residents building the sunroom they always wanted for their retirement, or replacing their back deck, or, you know, finishing off their basement. But now it's just the builders I talk to who are building the very expensive mansions tell me that money is not even part of the equation. These people do not, there's never a discussion of money. The discussion is, how soon can you do it? When a change has to be made, how soon can the change be made? And at no point is there ever, and how much is that going to cost me? It's a level of wealth in which the money is a very small part of their lives. The cost of doing the structures are not really considered, and that's kind of that I can't quite imagine for myself, but it's apparently that is the case for a lot of these very large homes that are going up right now. I think these are people that are making millions of dollars a year as salaries. I know Kevin Garnett, I think, is $20 million a year for a salary. I mean, so there is no limit to whatever they wish is they get. And so the key for most of these builders is that they have to be there, listen carefully, do exactly what they want in the time that they want it done in, and then everything is fine. It's really, and just keep submitting bills, the bills get paid.
Except for you. It's kind of a stumbling block for it.
Right. But I have developed a good relationship with most of the attorneys land use attorneys that deal with these issues. So I do spend a great deal of time solving problems before someone shows up at the counter looking for a permit. So it's taking place well before the lot's even purchased, well before the house is purchased. I spend hours with attorneys discussing what the issues will be on the lot, so that there is no mystery to them when their client finally signs and purchases the property.
So 10 years ago, your daily work really changed pretty significantly.
Yeah, I've never seen it this busy. in all the years I've been in Concord. When I first started, they hired me to work under Brad Nyhan, which was years ago, 85. And in 85, the reason they hired me was because building permits had jumped to over 300 permits a year. Last year, we issued 795 permits. And I have Laurie Lavoli is my assistant, and Ray Maddy is another full-time assistant. Excellent staff. And we end up handling great more construction. We'll go out in the morning and do 12 to 20 building inspections. That's the level of construction right now in Concord. And what that means is change. So everywhere you look in Concord, there are trash dumpsters in the yards. There are orange building cards in the yards. You can't go down on a street in Concord that there's not two or three of these, you know, dumpsters and yards. So that level of change really does, I think, make people anxious, make people wonder what's going on in their lives, and the change is happening so fast. So it's a very important thing, and I can understand that, because it is happening all throughout our community.
12 to 24 structures a day.
Yeah, electrical, plumbing, and building inspections. So I'll send out five inspectors to do inspections, and we issue permits. In the afternoon we do inspections in the morning, and this past summer we probably issued six permits a day for new houses, additions, renovations, a lot of commercial work. Last year we brought in $700,000 more in fees than it cost us to run our department. So that's because of the level of construction. We have actually, we've never seen this type of these fees coming in, the value of construction being so high. We've just never seen this level of construction in all the years I've been here. Concord's never experienced it. We've never issued this many permits, never brought in this amount of money. Construction value, we've sets new records practically every year.
What does that mean, construction value?
So we set a value on what, let's say you're going to build a $2 million home. So that is the value of construction that we add to all the other permits during that year, and we come up with a number, $68 million or $90 million, and of all of that work that's being done in Concord, and from 2006 to 2007, that jumped. It pretty much jumps 5%, then another 6%, and 8%.
What jumps?
The value of construction, the number of projects being built, and the value of construction. We have just gone through a period of incredible growth, and it's been just the last couple of months that we've finally seen the general malaise in the economy start to be affected in permits in Concord. And but having had the job for so many years, Concord is not like every other community. We tend to, when there's like called a recession, when there's a recession, we're down very slightly. And when the economy improves, then we head upward again. There's very little downside when there's a recession. We've gone through, two or three of these in the 23 years I've been in Concord. And recessions do not affect Concord construction as they do Burlington, Bedford, Acton. And I think it's because that there's a great deal of money. I don't know whether people sell stock short in a recession and they're making money, and then make money on the stocks go up when it's good. I don't know. I think there's they end up not being affected as everyone around us, really. It's an amazing town, actually, in that way. But we are down slightly right now on permits, and it's because of the what the economy is right in this day in January 2008. With that said, we have never had more construction planned for the year ahead in Concord's history. We have 550 new housing units that are now going through approval with the Planning Board and the Board of Appeals, so that the year ahead of us, we have two large 100,000 square foot commercial buildings on Baker Ave. We have 350 units of housing going up on the Acton line, another 150 up off Forest Ridge Road. And I heard one, just a new one the other day, is another 24 units. So we really are almost at, it must be 575 units right now in the planning process to be built next summer, next fall. And again, we will, if that happens, Concord has never seen that type of activity in the past.
How does that compare with preceding years?
Well, probably the most, we might have 20, 25 new homes, single family homes. And when there was a 40B project, which is an affordable housing unit, there was 40 units that went in that. That was 3 years ago. This will be one building permit for 350 units. One building permit for 150 units. So these are substantial projects, which will be under a state law called 40B development, which basically throws your zoning bylaw out the window.
Your what?
The zoning bylaw gets tossed out the window. And the 40B project means that they come into the town of Concord, they look at how many units are affordable units, and that formula has been set up by the state. What is an affordable unit? And if the town does not have 10% of their housing that is affordable, then you're subject to anyone coming into your community and proposing an affordable housing project under the statute 40B. And Concord now is at about 5% of the housing. They need 10. And so until we gain that last 5%, anyone can come into Concord and propose to build these developments. The 350 unit proposal that is at the Planning Board and Board of Appeals right now will entirely take care of the last 5%. But if it doesn't get built, then there's all these other, there's the 150 unit project, there's a 20 unit project just on Strawberry Road that's ready to be built, and the developer says April 1st they're going to break ground. So there's a number of projects all in line to be built, and my guess would be that within 2 years Concord will now have met the affordable housing criteria, so that anyone that comes in from there on, we can then go back to our zoning bylaw and say, this is the zoning bylaw, this is the requirement you have to meet. So if you imagine throwing the bylaw out, it means that you can go into a residential neighborhood where every house has to be no more than 35 foot in height, and you can build a six-story building with 40 units in it. That's what 40B projects can be, and we have those that have been built that make up the 5% already. And as you can imagine, talk about change, that really makes a lot of people upset when someone comes into the neighborhood and wants to build a cluster of 350 units of housing.
What do people say? People who are upset. Who are they? What are the organizations? And what are the arguments?
Well, usually neighbors will form a group and will hire attorneys to represent them. They'll go and speak at the hearings. In Concord, we have a process where everyone gets heard. So we will have a 40B project can go on for 6 months, 8 months, every month a new hearing on this and discuss traffic and, septic systems and water quality and noise issues and lighting issues, and everything gets discussed, and it does take a long time to go through that process. But the overall result of a 40B project is that if the town of Concord were to outright and deny it, the state court overturns it. So the best thing you can do is to negotiate with the developer and come up with all the safeguards that you try. You know, so if someone says, well, that building's too close to my house, and the light off of it will adversely affect my home and my living, if you can get the developer to shift the home back 30 or 40 feet, or the building, or the roadway, or the turn in the road so the lights don't flash on in their house, reduce the lighting in the parking lots or whatever. That's the sort of thing the board tries to do, because we have learned that you can't deny the project. You can try to change the project to fit in to the neighborhood that it's being fit into. But if you deny it, then it gets granted. And it gets granted by the state in the original form. So all the things that you've negotiated get thrown out the window and never get built into the project. So Concord, our Board of Appeals and our Planning Board, tremendously creative people, tremendous intelligent people, lawyers, landscape architects. We have really good boards in Concord. And you do constantly have to remind the public that, when you have 100 people show up at a hearing, the chairman is always saying, now you understand this is a 40B project. If we deny this, we do not meet the 10% requirement. The state will overturn this decision.
10%
of affordable housing, of a housing stock. So if you have 5,000 homes in Concord, 10% of those need to meet the affordability quotient that the state has set.
But that's always changing because there's so many new housing units being proposed.
Not only that, but when you build 350 units of affordable housing, you've just added another 350 to the equation that you have to provide 10% of. So you're kind of chasing it. But that's why, so when I told you 350 were coming at us, but there's another group of 150 and another of 20, well, the way that we look at it is that even if the 350 get built and that satisfies the equation, then the next time the number gets crunched, Concord's going to need to make up the difference, so that until we get that project built and another project built to make up those numbers, then we have not really caught up. We're almost caught up. So, but that, I would say that if the economy comes back over the next year and two or three of these projects get built out, Concord will have satisfied that requirement, and we will then be able to rely again upon our zoning bylaw to limit lot coverage and structure height and number of units on a lot, which Concord has done. Concord zoning bylaw, first adopted in February of 1928, has done a tremendous job of creating the town that we have, the look of the town, the feel of the town that we have today. It's been a great zoning bylaw. It was a well-written zoning bylaw right since 1928.
Why did they do that then?
Why did they?
Yeah, 1928. Why would they even be thinking that way?
In 1928, my guess would be that there was a new state law that was passed that allowed communities the ability to regulate local zoning, and Concord went right ahead and did that. Concord is a very progressive town. We tend to be out ahead of most of the other towns around. We have our own light plant. We tend to get into things that we are well ahead of every other town around, and we tend to have developed very careful, well-thought-out zoning really early on. And if you think about it, there are towns surrounding here which, you know, that are just strip malls. And those towns had very little zoning until, like, 50s, 60s. And at that point, the horse was out of stable. I mean, Concord had strict zoning back to 28. So and the value of that is reflected in the centers of our town. We had a historic districts in Concord. We wrote our own, and then the state legislature said, "Oh, that's a nice thing that towns should have," so that our historic districts is a special legislation that went through the state legislature to allow Concord to have historic districts. 3 or 4 years after that, the state adopted a standard which allowed towns to create historic districts.
When was that?
So that was in the early 60s, or maybe 1960. So we adopted our own, and, you know, again, it's been very, very effective. It protected all of the centers of town, the viewscapes up to Barrett's Mill Farm and out to the North Bridge and down Lexington Road as you enter the town on Lexington Road. It protected all those historic viewscapes that we wanted to protect. And it's done it nicely, actually.
Why did they decide that they better do that in the early 60s?
I think they saw the change happening back in the 60s, and people said, hey, we need to. Again, in the same manner that I now send people that are doing teardowns, I think there was a group of people, it was before my time, but people that said, at least if we can get these people in front of a board, of, you know, a knowledgeable board, no historical structures, architects, landscape architects, and have them review someone's project, then we'll be able to, you know, protect that streetscape. And that has truly been what has happened. Historic districts is a terrific tool to do that in Concord. I really think I gave a talk in front of the Concord Business Partnership last week, and they said, you know, what is driving all of this development in Concord? And I said, it's because you've done such a terrific job of creating this town over the years. The townspeople of Concord has made it a great place to live, a fantastic place to educate your children, and town. The management within the town is superb. Your zoning bylaw and historic districts are as tight as can be. I mean, why? There's your answer. It's a beautiful town, and everyone wants to live here. And so that's why the property values are going up. That's why so much construction is going on. That's why people want to be here, because Concord residents for so many years have done such a great job of making it a fantastic town to live in, to grow up in, to educate your kids. There's no mystery about it, really, you know. And so I don't think that was the answer they expected. They wanted something having to do with money, and yeah, I don't know. But that's truly what it is. You know, people want to live in Concord and educate their children in one of the 5 private schools in Concord or our fantastic public school system.
So how does this progressive town deal with the issues of servicing all the new residents?
Concord is in the same manner that we, so when I said the great town management, the town is always ahead of, you know, we do master planning, we always have, we predict what development will be ahead. We expand. We have our own water treatment plants. We're expanding our plants. We have a fund where if I issue a building permit for a house in which a new bedroom's added, there's $1,700 or $1,800 is added to this future fund for expansion of our water treatment plants. We developed our own well sites. We're lucky enough to have this We have this Concord River that runs through town, Sudbury River, and Assabet Rivers, and the Assabet River, and these rivers, Assabet, Assebet.
And these rivers
are all through Concord, and underneath that is this aquifer of before the glaciers came through Concord years ago, there was an old riverbed that runs right through Concord, and we're able to have developed wells for Concord, which take water from this old aquifer, which used to be an old riverbed, and so we have great drinking water from our own wells. We, like I said, we have our treatment plant that was developed really early. I would guess the 40s. It's then was expanded when I first came on in mid 80s. It's now under another expansion. So that great management, that planning, we keep ahead of the curve in terms of. I'd say the only thing that we've not been able to keep up with is, and it's a problem everywhere, is traffic. I mean, there's more people, more cars, and there's really, I'm not sure of any way around that, because, to get to Concord, we do have a train that comes through Concord, so you can, go into Boston on the train, really, it's tough to get around the traffic issue in Concord. I would say that's a real problem that needs to. I'm not sure how it's going to be addressed. Unless people give up their cars.
Or incentives somehow? Are there other options?
I'm not sure. It's people travel through Concord to get to some other destination. We have Route 2 that cuts through Concord. Some mornings it's tough. I live in West Concord. I work in Concord. It's tough to get across Route 2 some mornings. Because of the traffic, so that's a real problem for Concord, but it's a real problem for the country, for a lot of areas that are being developed in many parts of the country.
Is there public transportation?
There are certain levels of public transportation. The train, there is Concord. Bus system for the elderly, and that's it.
I've heard the term green building. Is that the correct term? Can you say that? Talk a little bit about. Does that play a role? What are we talking about?
It will be.
What are you talking about? I'm sorry.
Green construction. It's the term. We're now dealing, we have a new Willard School that has been designed, and I've reviewed the plans. Town meeting voted for the money to build it. It's a so-called green structure. There's various levels of, and green means, what does it mean? It means very well insulated, uses very little energy, or less energy than a standard structure would use. You insulate it to a higher level of insulation, you try to creatively use all the resources, electricity, oil or gas heating. This structure, if it's still on the drawing board, is to collect the water off the roof to flush toilets and urinals within the building, put it in storage chambers and water the playing fields with the water from the roof. So it's these types of things that will be part of this so-called green school. And one of the advantages of that is that the state is now willing to pay for structures that are green before they pay for all other types of schools. So we've also placed ourselves in a position where we are eligible for a certain level of funding, and even be on the list for the funding, because the building's status as a so-called green building. I haven't done it justice. There are, as you can imagine, there's very energy efficient lighting. There's use of natural light in classrooms, so you don't even have to switch on lights in classrooms because of skylights and windows, and the siding of the classrooms towards the south and, you know, east and west, and natural heat gain from natural windows towards the south, and distributing through heating and air conditioning systems, distributing heat gained in one area to other areas that are to the northern side of the building. All that is part of the green, so-called green construction. And this new school will have that. The last two elementary schools.
Which school does the school have a name?
Yeah, it'd be Willard School. It's on Powder Mill Road in Concord, corner of Plainfield. And the other two elementary schools that were just built did not have any of these elements built in. They had a higher level of whatever the building code required for insulation, and they met the code requirement. But what we, because of this interest in, you know, basically making this country a little more self-sufficient, in the future I see the building code changing to reflect a higher level, you know, basically adopting these types of green requirements into the state building code, so that every structure will have some of these elements. Some are good elements, some are not good elements. I mean, it's just some crazy ideas that if you act too quickly on it, you don't have the benefit of knowing that it just doesn't work. Or so, you know, one of the things that you have to do with water that comes off of your roof is you then have to put it through either oxygenization or treat it with chlorine in order before you introduce it into bathrooms. And sometimes when you start to look at what does it mean and what are the costs of that, it may cost you more to do something like that than it actually just to use the water out of the faucet. So they're working through those right now with this particular school, and we're hoping to adopt as many of these so-called green construction techniques as we possibly can, and do the ones that'll be effective for Concord, and we'll have reasonable payback period of time.
Sorry.
We'll have a reasonable payback period of time. So if you, I just did a proposal to change out all the lighting in my building, and to a higher efficient lighting system, and the payback period for that will be 4.8 years. So you have to look at, because it's going to cost us $6,000, and we'll pay it off. We'll be getting money back in 4.8 years, and does that make sense? And you have to then decide, does that make sense for the town to do that? You're basing it on the cost of electricity today, and you know that in 4 years, the cost of electricity will be much higher. So as we do this in town buildings, we'll be able to, you know, make energy savings. And the ultimate goal, the town manager's office, the ultimate goal is if we can save, you know, $5,000 in heating costs in my building, that gives us $5,000 we can then take and spend for the next improvement, you know, seals on doors and windows, replace windows and doors, add more insulation in the attic, whatever it might be, better heating, air conditioning controls. So we're... that's the goal of the town now, is to not only just do it with our school and make it green, but the town manager actually has a committee in which we're now looking at every town building otherwise and doing retrofit projects to make them as best we can adopt to a higher insulation, better, more efficient lighting. Be able to switch out half the lights in each room instead of using. So if you come in, you switch the light, and every light comes on, we want to give people the option to switch on half that level of lighting, which, as you can imagine, saves half the cost of the electricity in that room. And the room we're in here today, we don't need lights, and so we'd like to give people that option in every town building to do that. Pretty simple thing. You can save half your energy, and if that happens through all the town buildings, that's a substantial amount of money. If it happens throughout the country by changing building codes, as you can imagine, that would save a tremendous amount of energy. So those kind of things I'm looking forward to seeing changes in the building codes, as well as the construction of town buildings.
Can you affect those changes?
Again, Concord is well managed. We now have we have almost $1 million, I hear, to that's been set aside for taking our buildings in town and doing creative energy saving things within the buildings, whether it be saving water, saving electricity, or insulating the shells of buildings so we don't have as much heat loss or cooling loss. We have the money. It's in an account, and it's up to the building managers, such as myself, in my building to we have an energy audit that's been done for every building. We have the results of the energy audit. It's like a formula for me to follow that I know which has the best payoff, so I can do the following, and you'll get this type of return. And I'm now working through that for my own building and proposing that we spend certain amounts of money to start to carry out those improvements. So it is well thought out, it's funded, and it's in the process. So
your own building is?
Yeah, I'm down in the old, I'm at 141 Kais Road, which is an old power plant that the Concord Light Plant built in the late 1800s, and we renovated it. I moved over there, we converted it from this old power plant to my offices. Must have been 14 years ago. And so I'm in this great old brick, big arch window building that used to be a power plant that used to offload coal from railroad cars, and they'd dump it into the basement, and they'd fill the boilers, and we'd make our own electricity. It ran for very few years, like 5 years, and Concord realized, the Concord Light Plant realized that they could buy electricity less expensively from Boston Edison. So after 5 years of this plant running, we stopped making power and we started buying power through the Boston Edison grid, and we've never gone back. But that great old brick structure is what is now my office, and I was lucky enough to have been handed the project by the town manager, saying, "Here, work with the architect and design your own office." And so the first meeting, the architect said to me, "So where do you want your office?" And the very first thing he said, and so from there on, it was nice. I was able to actually work with the architect and pick. I picked out the nicest corner of the building to be my office, which was kind of great. So, and I've been there, like I said, about 14 years. We've been in that building. But in just 14 years, there have been changes in thinking and changes in construction quality and change in insulating systems and change in lighting systems, so that in just 14 years, there are entirely new ways to insulate buildings, entirely new ways to light buildings, different way people think about using, you know, lighting in their office spaces. And we're going to be, in just 14 years, we now have to basically remodel our building to bring in some of those so-called green aspects of construction, which is a very short period of time. When you look at structures in Concord that are, you know, 200-year-old homes, 300-year-old homes, that, you know, it's 14 years and already there's this amount of change in the construction field that you would have to renovate and change the whole lighting systems and so forth. And I anticipate that's ahead of us in this country, if we don't want to keep going overseas for oil and become more dependent on that. We really, that's what you will be seeing, and like I said, in the building code. It'll be changing dramatically, because it really has to. We have no other option than to do that, I would think.
Yeah, and you mentioned water and problems with having to add chlorine to roof water, but I mean, do they call it gray water?
Yeah, it's gray water is what they call it.
What is that?
You know, so it's well, gray water might be, Board of Health would call gray water something that has been water that's been used, like for washing clothes or taking a shower or something, but it's not like toilet water. They would consider anything that's water that's reusable, gray water, and off the roof. I'm not sure. I don't know if they call that gray water. But it's because if you introduce it just to in the building for, well, certainly use it out in the fields,